So I'm going to start with saying a bit about kind of receiving input in a skillful way that works for us, and how we might work with that in this session. And then let's do a Shakyamuni chant, and then I'll say some more. So on the team, part of our role in holding the retreat is to try to stay sensitive to what's the right amount of input. And it's really interesting because, of course, beings are very different in dependence on conditions. And in any one moment, what's right for one, what's right for us, for one person, it's not going to be right for someone else. So we've been really trying to, sense into what's right in that balance, knowing at the same time that in any one moment it's not going to be quite right for everybody. So something that can help, I think, is just how we receive input. So if we're feeling that something is a bit too much, it's too much, it's causing too much clicking and worrying of the mind for where we're at, is it possible? It's a question. Is it possible to just sort of let it wash over us and just receive, just be porous to what we need? What's fruitful, what's helpful for where we're at in that particular moment, or more generally, where we're at in our practice. So, in this session, just really invite you to receive what's useful and, if possible, to just let the rest go. Let it go. Let it flow in what's helpful. Let the rest wash over you. And I sometimes find that I've heard something, I hadn't particularly registered it, and then sometime later, bizarrely, it just pops up. We find this, don't we? It was in there somewhere, and then at a suitable moment, when it's ready to be received, up it pops. So just trusting that. I was awake in the night, as I quite often am, especially when I'm giving a talk, or find my mind gets very active about 4 o'clock in the morning, and in my mind and heart was Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a very lovely and amazing teacher. He's had a stroke, probably some people know, so he's no longer able to teach, but there's an incredible wealth, beautiful teachings recorded and videos as well. And I was remembering him because he said this amazing thing. I heard him say, he said, it's okay to sleep in the Dharma talk because it will go in anyway. So I found that quite challenging. Really? Really? Anyway, that was his view, and he's very wise. So I'm not suggesting, I'm not quite there. I'm not suggesting that we all lie down and go to sleep and just allow it to permeate into our subconscious, but it's just it's an interesting thought. And it made me, I was thinking about him, this is a bit of an aside, but it was something that I wanted to mention, which is something that fascinates me about him is that he has this incredible sort of malleability in his being. So sometimes the way he looks, it's incredibly sort of childlike, in a way that you don't so often see in adults. You know, that incredible sort of pure, beautiful openness that you can get in children, especially young children. And you can see that sometimes. There's that kind of complete openness to beauty. And then sometimes he's quite fierce, quite Vajra-like. You can do those both things. And what I heard him be, one time I heard him be really Vajra-like, He said, Buddhism is not Buddhism if it's not engaged. And that really went in for me. And I think, you know, that's very much what Bhante gives to us. It's not on the cushion or off the cushion, it's both. So we enter into wisdom in order to generate compassion, and then the nature of that is that it wants to act, it wants to respond, it wants to, engage with suffering in the world. And both, it's all, can't separate those things. So something they do in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition I really love is that one, they punctuate the talks with bells, and they use this kind of bell to create some space, just to create some space for the absorbing, to allow it to sort of really percolate into the being. And something they do sometimes is someone's giving a talk and they have someone else who's there to support them in creating enough space in that talk. So they might notice that the speaker themselves is got a bit up here and needs to have a bit of space. So they're inviting them. So they just ring the bell and invite some space in. Or they might notice, have a sense of like, actually, that, hold on, whoa, we're going too fast there. Let's just have some space. I hope we can solve that. So Maitri Devi, it's great working with Maitri Devi because I experience her as having this very sensitive barometer to input, to too much input especially. And I really appreciate that. So I would like to invite her to be my bell support. And with support. Thank you. And with this reminder that the sound of the bell is inviting, it's the call to awakening, it's a call to wake up. So let's have a bell and then a mantra. Would anyone like to lead the Shakyamuni mantra that we've been doing? So just in our own time, we'll have a bell, and then when you're ready, JT, if you'll lead the mantra.
Om Muni Muni Ma. Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni 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 Shakya Muni Shakya Muni Swaha.
just a thought about writing, taking notes. Sometimes it can be hard to listen on the writing, so just know that the talk is hopefully, well, it's being recorded, so hopefully it'll be available. And I'm going to try to write something as well to summarise some of it. Yeah. It's gone a bit quiet after the mantra. It's hard to speak into that beautiful silence. So just going to recap sort of some of what Vijayamala was saying yesterday about this phase of Dharma as reference, metta with Dharma as reference. So in this phase we are seeing beings through the lens of the Dharma, the lens of the teachings. And this takes us into a focus on the nature of experience rather than the content of experience. What we can learn from the detail of human lives about what it means really to be happy, to be free. What are the root conditions for freedom and happiness? So that freedom, that release of the heart, that vastness of heart that we long for deep down, and that we can see underneath our craving and grasping, and that's there even under the most deluded behaviour, is that longing, that desire to be happy. I was reading Sharon Salzberg, lovely book on loving kindness. She's saying that our desire for happiness is like a sort of homing instinct that takes us towards freedom. Can sort of trust that, feel what's underneath it. And we can look, we can look when there's craving, we can look for the heart wish that's underneath that. I'll say a bit more about that later. So with craving, this is our confused, deluded grasping, our seeking for happiness in the wrong place. False refuge, false refuges. I was thinking of Hakuin's Song of Meditation. Some people probably know that it's the one where he's saying all beings are from the very beginning Buddhas, it's like water and ice. Outside water, no ice. Outside living beings, no Buddhas. Other way around it should be, shouldn't it? It's like ice and water. And then he says, not knowing it is near, we seek it from afar. What a pity. And those words have sort of been resonating with me. What a pity. Because it's... yeah, I mean, in a way, that bit doesn't matter so much, because it's just, you know, it applies to everything, all of our suffering. So, but in this case, he's talking about awakening. Not knowing it is near, we seek it from afar. What a pity. It is like water and ice. Outside, it's like ice and water. Outside ice, no water. Outside living beings, no Buddhas. So in those words, water pity, I really feel like you can feel in that the kind of aching heart of the Bodhisattva. And what I love about it is that it's so quiet, you know, it's so quiet, those words. It's like there's that you can feel the equanimity in that. It's seen, the condition that we're in, the condition that beings are in. It's like, what a pity. It's so, freedom is so possible, and yet we don't see it. It's not seen. And sometimes when there's compassion, when compassion does have a lot of stillness in it, a lot of equanimity, it can be very subtle. It can feel very subtle, very quiet. And we can miss that, actually. We can be looking for a big experience. Often what happens with metta practice, we fail to sort of see the metta that's actually there. We're looking for it to look a particular way, feel a particular way. So there's this, in those words, it evokes this kind of ache of compassion. And in the Pali Canon, in the Buddha, there's a couple of words used for compassion. So there's karuna, and there's also anukampa, which means something like quivering. Quivering, or you could say resonating. I think that's really interesting because unlike the English word compassion, which means to suffer with, the Buddha's not, that kind of gives the wrong idea. It's like we don't want to suffer in the same way as the person that we're feeling compassion towards. If we do, then all that means is that there's an increase in the total sum of suffering, which is not what we're wanting. So it's a very different thing. It's a kind of, it's a resonating. We're resonating with suffering, but not a falling into the same suffering. I want to say a bit more about this distinction between the content of experience and the nature of experience. So the content of experience is that it's the detail, it's all the detail, the story, the fabric of conditioned appearances. And it's not, as Vijayamala was saying, it's not that we are dismissing that or moving past that, bypassing that. It's all there on our metta washing line. And it really matters. But to know and see the root of what can free us, we have to see what that stuff means, what that experience means, what it's showing us about human experience, the common ground. So I thought I'd use an example. So supposing I wake up and I find that I have a cold, and then I'm annoyed and grumpy that I find I have a cold, and then I snap at the first person that I see, and then I feel bad that I've snapped at them. So anybody relate to this? this is common or garden human experience, isn't it? So, what's going on? What is the dharmic nature of this? So, in this, we can see impermanence, anicca, emptiness, or embeddedness, ungraspability, limitlessness. We need quite a lot of words, I think, to unpack anatta or shunyata, to give it the fullness of its meaning. And we can see dukkha, And in all of those, we can see conditionality. So conditionality is in the underpinning all of it. So impermanence. The cold has arisen in dependence on conditions, of course. And the annoyance is a resisting, isn't it? Often there's a feeling like, well, I didn't have a cold yesterday and now I've got a cold. And I want to feel like I did yesterday because I've got important things to do. So, as Vijayanand was saying, when we're resisting that flow, aren't we? There's the dukkha. Because also, we are forgetting, as we do over and over again, that this is a passing experience. When we've got a physical experience, an emotional experience, we just forget that it's not going to last. Over and over again. Am I right? We forget it, don't we? Just like when the sun is shining, yippity-dee-da. I even found this when I was living for a large part of the year outside, and I'm seeing over and over again that in the course of a day the weather is constantly changing. Even then I would forget and go for a walk or whatever and not take my raincoat because it's sunny or whatever, you know, and then, you know, suffer the consequences. So yeah, it's interesting. I've sort of heard from two people recently, both of whom have been practicing in quite extreme conditions, about the liberating power of seeing impermanence. So one of them I've met, and he did a long prison sentence for a high-profile bank robbery. And now he's doing amazing work, compassionate activity, and he's going to give a talk at Butterfield Festival because he's an amazing speaker. And he found the Dharma whilst he was in prison. And, you know, very rough childhood, loads of suffering. In prison, came in touch with, in contact with the Dharma, and then he realised that he needed to turn towards, come to terms with what had happened in his childhood, and he needed to do some therapy. And he said the thing that allowed him to do that work and really turn things around in his life was the Dharmic teaching of impermanence, and really knowing that however excruciatingly painful his experiences were in any one moment when he was doing that therapy, it was not going to last. And you could see in him someone who'd really taken that into their being. And same thing I've read in this amazing couple of books I've read recently by a guy called Jarvis J. Masters. Anybody? Yeah, so he's a Buddhist African-American. He's on death row for a crime that he almost certainly didn't do. He may now be released, actually, having served 23 years or something. He did do the initial thing that got him in the prison, and then other stuff unfolded. Anyway, he wrote in his autobiographical writings, which are amazing, about this same thing, that it was that teaching that really has allowed him to practice in the most extreme conditions. So he's taken the Bodhisattva vow, and in these writings he speaks about how in prison there have been quite a number of opportunities to actually save people's lives, whether it's somebody who wants to kill themselves or witnessing a plot to murder a prison guard and intervening in a way, a skillful way to stop that happening. Absolutely amazing. So I've been very struck by that. And Dharma's so curious because it's so simple, isn't it? It's like at root. And yet, and yet, and yet, and yet, our ignorance is, you know, our delusion is so deep that we can't take those simple truths in, or there's such resistance. So that knowing that everything changes, we have to see it in our own experience. So this is the essence of insight practice, of a wisdom practice, that it's somehow over and over again, we have to actually see it for it to really see it in our own experience, for it to really permeate, for it to really go in, sufficient for it to transform the heart. And with impermanence, it often has a bad press, because we associate it with mortality and death, and we forget the other side, the liberating side, that it, you know, the bad stuff, the painful stuff changes too. A little quote from Bounty about this. If I can find it. From Living with Kindness, all things change as we know to our sorrow. But this very fact becomes the source of joy when we realize that we ourselves have the power to change ourselves and our experience. Because there's nothing fixed there, because it's all arising out of conditions, we have the power to change ourselves and our experience. So, I have a cold. I compare my experience with yesterday. I forget that it's a passing experience. And then the dharmic nature of this experience is also that it's empty, it's ungraspable. So, in my annoyance and my reactivity, I'm solidifying my experience. I'm fixing it. How am I fixing it? Well, labels and names are part of fixing. So the label a cold can be handy if you, you know, these labels are handy, but they are also have their downside. And it's not just language, you know, it's the underlying conceiving of things as fixed and separate. But labels kind of contribute to that. And it's this weird thing that they, you know, they give this illusion of permanence, words. So you say cold, you know, it doesn't convey the anything of the changing nature of that experience. We slap a label on something, we think we know what it is then. So when we slap a label on something, put it in a box and have a story about it, we fail to see that that experience has lots of holes in it. So what does that mean? It means it's not, you know, so for example, you know, supposing I say I'm grumpy. What does that mean? Does that mean that I'm grumpy in every second? What about if in the middle of the grumpiness, I have a beautiful, happy thought? But we fix, don't we? Quite often it's like, you know, some thoughts or whatever, or some sensations arise in the body. We slap a label on grumpy. And then that perpetuates it, because then we kind of, we have this view, that's what's going on. We fail to see the holes in the experience. So we're giving it substance, that experience. We're solidifying it. And then the other bit that I'm making solid is the I have a cold. Language is a funny thing. How's that supposed to work? I have a cold. And you can see it very clearly if you take an example like, it is raining. Where is the it bit? Exactly. It is raining. It is raining. There is no it. It's obvious, isn't it? It's completely obvious. There is no it that is raining. There's just raining. That's it. Even rain's a bit of a weird one, because where is the rain, you know? Is it rain when it's, you know, when it's fallen to the ground, it's a puddle, isn't it? You'd call it a puddle. So it's raining. It's just raining. Raining is... Thich Nhat Hanh's good on this. The only accurate, the more accurate way, the most accurate way in words would be to just say raining. Okay, so then it comes to I. You have this word. You say, I have a cold. I'm sleepy. There isn't an I bit. There's just the experience. Sleepiness or coldiness. And as Bhante says again in Living with Kindness, this idea, which is just an idea, a very, very painful idea, that there's this I separate from experience, is the root cause. Is one of the roots. It's right there at the root of our suffering, isn't it? It's an exhausting story. The yak, yak, yak. Painful, exhausting story of I. So then, the dharmic nature of this experience of a cold and feeling grumpy, so on, is that it's dukkha, isn't it? This fabricating of a self, this fixing of the experience is dukkha. When we resist the flow, there's dukkha. And when we embrace the flow, there's freedom. So, when we are caught and stuck in the detail and the content of experience, we can't find freedom. So to find freedom, we need to find freedom from suffering, we need to feel the roots of suffering and pull them out. And this is what the wisdom teachings can do. So if we have a deadly poisonous plant and then we just snip off the flowers, then, you know, snip them off before it goes to seed, then it can't seed other deadly poisonous plants. But it's not going to do anything about that plant. So to address, you know, just to destroy that plant, you need to pull it out from the roots. So comes into my mind this image of Manjushri, who has the sword of wisdom, which is the sword that cuts into one, because it cuts through the illusion of duality, the illusion of separation. And I have this image of It's cutting the taproot of suffering. That's, yeah, I'm not quite sure where that appears in the Pali Canon, but I think that there is an image in there. No, about the taproot of suffering. Okay. Yeah. Manjushri is not in the Pali Canon, you know. But I think there is something there about the taproot of suffering. Let's look it up. Yeah. Yes, so cuts it. So this is what the Buddha is offering us, the means to cut the taproot of suffering. That's all he's interested in. So, the Buddha says, it's translated in different ways, but I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering and the end of suffering. Both bits important. Both bits are there in the Tonglen practice, which was important. So in the in-breath is the reality of suffering, and on the out-breath there's the knowing that freedom from it is possible and the wishing of that. So in terms of the noble truths, the first two, the reality of suffering and its cause, and the second two, the medicine, the freedom. So let's just take a moment to reflect. So what is it that the Buddha is saying that we need to know and see? What is insight into dukkha, actually? What's he saying that we really need to know and see and understand to be free? I'm just dropping that question in. Okay, so first noble truth, there is suffering. Second noble truth, it arises from craving. The word's tanha, which literally means thirst, and it stands for both craving and aversion, which is, I think, Maitri Devi was saying, they're two sides of the same coin. When this word clinging is used, the word clinging. It conveys both of those. Yeah, both of those, craving and aversion. The push-pull. The push-pull. So we think that the reason for our unhappiness is not getting the things that we crave. That is standard underlying deluded view. If I had that, I'd be happy. Had that experience, that spiritual experience even. So what the Buddha is saying is turning it round. It's not that, it's the deluded craving or aversion itself that is the cause of suffering. So I wanted to use an example here from my own experience. I often turn away from my painful experience through the means of cake or other sweet things, ice cream or biscuits or sweet stuff. So, for example, if I experience anxiety or frustration, there's a tendency to turn away from that and go for the cake. So I wanted to use the example of something that frequently winds me up, that I get frustrated about, which is the Buddha Field program is yet again not out early enough, as early as other retreat centers get there. I've tried my hardest, and yet again, it's not come together. So there's frustration and that kind of thing. And depends on that, I reach for cake. So Bhante uses that example of going for sweet things in Living with Kindness, and says a little bit about that. He's talking about actual sweets. But so he says, our desire for the things we crave seldom bears any relation to the capacity of those things to satisfy that craving. People usually eat sweets not because of their flavor, but because of the temporary experience of reassurance they give. But reassurance is intangible and certainly not to be found in a plastic wrapper. So we are more or less certainty to be disappointed. And then the next bit is he goes on, so then having failed to assuage our craving for reassurance, and in the absence of any more creative options, we're likely just to eat another sweet. We know this, don't we? So reassurance is not to be found in sweetness. So it's not the not getting cake that's the cause of the dukkha here. It's the craving, the deluded craving, and then, the delusion that's under that, and the resistance of the experience. So that's what's going on with craving and aversion, as Vijayamala was saying. It's basically resistance to experience, whether on a very, very subtle level or a gross level. And it's in this example, it's the resisting or the refusing of that experience of anxiety or frustration. And then underneath that, there's the resisting or refusing of the situation that I'm frustrated by. So often you get this layering. There's an experience with a feeling tone. We resist that, and then we resist the resistance. And there might be more layers And then often, I don't know whether I'm sure people relate to this, we can add a sort of spiritual practitioner layer of resistance, which is that I'm being so blooming reactive, I shouldn't be, I've been practicing for so long, blah, blah, blah. So we add another little extra layer on the top. So it can get quite complicated. So, third noble truth, freedom is possible. There's nothing because there's nothing fixed here. So dukkha arises out of these definite conditions, everything does. And so, if those conditions cease, then dukkha ceases. I know this is really, really basic dharma. I know it is. I know that we will have heard it many times, but my experience is I need to hear it loads. In different ways for it to go in. I feel I'm So the condition that is causing the dukkha is the resistance, the clinging, the craving. And Bhante has a very lovely formulation of this, which I can't come back to, which is, it's by trying too hard to escape from unhappiness that we fail to do so. I think that's put really, really well. We're caught, aren't we? We're trying to move away from the suffering, and in that trying to move away, we're actually increasing it. It's like we're kind of binding ourselves, wriggling, and we're binding ourselves more tightly in doing so. So how do we let go of the clinging that causes the suffering? Well, we've been doing this practice, haven't we? We've been doing this practice of opening to the difficult, turning towards it, letting go, allowing as much as we're able. And we've been working with the body, opening in the body, relaxing. So this is why relaxing, you know, it's deep spiritual practice, because it is addressing that clinging, which is the root of suffering. And then we're looking at how that expression in the body, that tightening in the body, always goes with a tightening in the mind. The tightening of the space of awareness, those two things co-arise. You loosen in one, then the other will loosen and open. So another way of saying this is that it's how we relate to our experience that liberates. And Vijayamala was emphasizing this. It's like how we relate to this moment conditions the next moment. If we relate with clinging, suffering. If we relate with opening, freedom. Resist that flow, dukkha. Embrace it, freedom. So, we resist the flow. Know that resistance in the body. That resistance is always there in the body. Wherever there's dukkha, wherever there's craving, wherever there's holding on to self, it's always going with this tightening in the body. But why do we do that? Why do we resist? What's conditioning that resistance, that clinging? So I thought we could do a short reflection now. I've done quite a lot of talking, so just doing a little meditative exercise. So we're going to bring in some dukkha, so just choosing wisely You might not even want to do this exercise, depending on how we're doing. Feel free to just take a little bit of space if you don't want to, but you might not want to bring in the most full-on thing. Just bringing in something that's current, or even something that's there right now. So, as we bring in something where there's dukkha for us, noticing that in the body. And seeing if we can get a sense of the view. Thoughts, can they show us what's the view going on? How is the resistance manifesting in terms of conceiving of this, perceiving? What conditions are we ignoring? Or part of this situation or experience? Part of what builds it? So, at the center of the wheel of samsara, we've got three animals. We've got greed and hatred, otherwise known as craving and aversion. We've also got ignorance, delusion. And the three animals are kind of, they're eating each other's tails, I think, aren't they? They're sort of chasing each other, they're all entangled. So, ignorance and craving and aversion all kind of build each other. They co-arise. So, when we have this experience of the mind tightening, closing around an experience, which then brings this tightness in the body, what's happening? So there's a kind of fixing onto something, isn't there? And a kind of cutting it out from the flow, from the matrix of conditions. So we're making it separate. So we're sort of cutting, we do this in sort of time and in space, so we cut things out from the flow of time, and we cut things out from the sort of embeddedness in space. And when we're doing that, yeah, we're not seeing, there's an ignoring of impermanence, there's an ignoring of this non-separateness, embeddedness. Right, that everything is relational. So, if I come back to this example of the Butterfield program, so I want to find a definite cause for that, that I can fix onto and feel annoyed about. This is what we do, don't we? I want ideally a person, that person. This is delusion. I can't find, if I really am honest, I'm just come up against a whole load of conditions. And any person that I want to give responsibility to, they're embedded in a load of conditions. It's inseparable from those conditions. But we still do it, don't we? We do that blaming. Well, it's interesting because I've done quite a lot of around this, and actually it feels like even though we've got somebody, two really good people now involved with the publicity work, somehow it's still happening. There's bigger conditions, actually, that's what I'm finding. So, when we embrace the fluidity and the embeddedness, the natural response to that is a letting go of clinging. And hopefully this has started to become a little bit clear with some of the reflections we brought in with the metta practice. If we see beings as embedded, ungraspable, mysterious, not separate, and we see their fluidity, embedded in conditions. So I'm talking about the whole area of emptiness, that things are not separable, they're not graspable, they're not separate because they're embedded in everything else. Yeah. Connected is sometimes what uses word. The only disadvantage of that word is it makes it sound like they're separate things. Whereas embeddedness gives more of a sense of the word that Thich Nhat Hanh uses, of interbeing, that things cannot be separate. There are no separate things to be connected. Mm. It's deeper than that. It goes even deeper than that. Mm. We don't have the words for it. That's why Thich Nhat Hanh came up with this new word of interbeing. Yeah. So I had an experience of this once. I was on retreat. I was watching these two squirrels chasing each other around this oak tree. And I suddenly switched to sort of imagining their experience from the inside. You know, mm-hmm. what that would be like. And I don't have a huge amount of compassion in relation to animals. It's not a strength of mine. I don't often feel that connected. But there was such a strong response just from that way of looking, that kind of lens of seeing that fluidity. And I find it can work very beautifully with fourth stage metta, is to see that being in context. Have a bigger view, rather than cutting them out, have a bigger view of them. Well, first of all, they can't be cut out from the elements. You know, they're breathing in, they're standing on the ground, all of that, going that way. But also, there's all these other beings that are affecting them. And I find that that softens the clinging, the aversion. So, ignorance, fundamental ignorance, causes clinging, causes resistance in terms of the fluidity, the embeddedness, and also in terms of dukkha. This is where the first noble truth comes in. Very, 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 very simple. There is suffering. Life has difficulties. No one can control it all. Why not? Because it's all arising out of conditions. So this is another thing that we ignore, isn't it? Really, that we don't actually know. Not really, not in a way, yeah. That there is suffering, that is how it is. And that it is part of the human condition. So this view that suffering, that dukkha shouldn't be happening, and that it's somehow particular to me when I'm experiencing it, can have lots of different flavours to it. So when we're saying it's somebody's fault, that is a moving away from the... Oh, it is the nature of things. It is independence on conditions. It's not my fault. It's not their fault. Or sometimes we blame, if only these conditions, if only that, if only... That phrase, if only, is really of the essence of that moving away from the truth, the first noble truth. If only. If only I'd done this, it would have worked out okay. If only they'd done that, it would have worked out okay. If only I wasn't like this, it would have been right. And then there's also this aspect of thinking that it's particular to me. And this is so much of what we're working with the Tonglen, what the Tonglen brings. It's cutting through that aspect of the delusion. Because when we get into that, it's particular to me, then there's the kind of feeling sorry for ourselves, which I've noticed recently, that thread in myself actually. which has been quite painful to see. I can sort of see conditioning that's led to it, but a story, there's a story there. For me, I don't have enough time to do all the things that I'm committed to, is the story. So we need to really see and know with the heart that others feel this. So insights with the heart, it's a seeing and knowing with the heart that touches the heart. When it's really going in, the heart is responding. And there's something about really, when we're really in an experience of dukkha, then it's really, really vivid. And then it can be really vivid that other people feel this if we bring that reflection in. That's why it works so well with the Tonglen. It's like this anxiety that I'm feeling right now, can I allow that to be a bridge? Can I allow that to be compost, that suffering to be compost for compassion? Because I'm tasting it right now. So it's vivid. And Butterfield, a few years ago, I really got into this, me and a few of us actually really got into this metaphor of compost. Because it's great for Butterfield, because we have compost toilets. And so you could think that in terms of the First Noble Truth, a good sort of colloquial version of that is... Shit happens. Yeah. Shit happens. But it's what you do with it that matters. You can turn it into compost. It's amazing. It's quite amazing seeing this stuff, you know, that was shit. You can crumble it, you know, after a couple of years. You can literally, it's got no smell. It's lovely earth. You can crumble it in your hand and you can grow stuff with it. You can grow flowers or whatever. It's completely clean. Yeah, it's quite amazing. So what can we grow in the compost of dukkha? Well, there's quite a lot of things. I mean, the classic thing is that dukkha leads to faith, isn't it? It's like off the circle of samsara, onto the spiral. Dukkha is the place. Leads to faith. And but then also it leads to insight, can lead to insight and compassion. So there's a lot that we can grow in that compost. If we give it wise attention, allow it to be felt. So this practice of turning towards, it's not just that we're alleviating our own suffering by not resisting experience. It's like it can allow insight and compassion, because we're really seeing the mechanism. Vijayanala talked about this, the mechanism of suffering, really seeing that, tasting it, knowing it. And Pema Chodron, she's fantastic for all of this, about turning towards. And she talks about the soft spot. So this is the place where you are not resisting anymore. You're kind of allowing the rawness of suffering. And she talks about how incredibly hard it is to do that. It's like we're built... It's so built into our being, that habit of moving away. But if we can do the opposite thing and just turn towards and not move, she talks about not moving to left or right, but finding that place where we're there, we're letting it be felt, turning towards it. And she said, when you really feel the rawness, that's the seed of the bodhicitta. I find that really inspiring. And it can be really hard to find that place. Sometimes I've had this image that it's like, it's kind of like I'm trying to find that place of just being with, and there's the aversion and there's the pulling and the pushing, and I can't quite find it, and I'm feeling around for it, and it's like, oh, there it is. And there's a kind of bitter sweetness in that place. And what's really interesting with this movement of knowing that, knowing our experience as dukkha, in other words, that other people feel this, is that it doesn't just lead to a compassion, but it also lessens our own suffering, because it's cutting that illusion of separation. And in, you know, there's this weird aspect of delusion that we think it's just us. Really curious and really interesting to really feel that when we can notice it in ourselves. We might do that reflection, other people feel this, and it slides off. That's what I often find. To have to bring patience. About it sliding, about the, yeah. So part of delusion is not knowing that we all suffer. And when we have the experience of suffering, we particularize about it, and we see it as me and mine. And we don't see that this experience, okay, it's particular, but other people feel stuff like this. This is human experience. And in that, we suffer more because we feel separate. Okay. So, ignorance leads to clinging, and then it also goes the other way. So, when we cling on, I'll just give one example of this. When we cling, there's this tightening in the body. And that tightening kind of builds that illusion of us being separate and solid. It's really interesting to watch that. So the sense of self, the sense of the separate self, gets stronger when we clench. So we're resisting something. We're tightening the body and we feel separate. When we let go, there's more of a sense of us being porous. There's this lovely, I'm not quite sure which poem it is of Bhante's, but there's a phrase in it where he says, letting the wind blow through you. So it's letting ourselves be permeable, porous. Letting the wind blow through us. I'm just going to say one more thing, which is to just bring in the story of Kisa Gotami. So anybody not familiar with that story, the mustard seed story? Okay, great, so we will know that story. Because this is the Buddha using that teaching, other people feel this, to lead someone very skillfully to awakening. And that story has been very present for me recently, because some friends in Buddhafield Sangha, their 7-month-old baby died. And it was a real huge thing actually in Sangha because of the way they were with it, which was incredibly open. They shared the experience, and the funeral was amazing. So it very much evoked that. And then also recently at Bristol Centre, Shivala Mali told the story of Kisa Gotami in the first person, which is incredibly powerful. Mm. Very moving. And what I love is that in this story, what's come down to us is her words as well, and her words of her awakening. which arose out of this experience. I haven't actually got the verse, but I know she describes it as the great dark was torn apart. And Sister Kisa Gotami, with a free mind, has said this. I find that very wonderful to just hear that description of awakening. Okay. So let's have a break. There's a lot of words. And let's come back in 15 minutes. And we'll do a meditation with a little bit of guiding in the first part, and then an open.